gutted Stratfor's servers of their data, removing everything they could find, including backups. In what Antisec described as an act of loving egalitarian criminality, they attempted to use 30,000 of the credit cards to donate an estimated $700,000 to the Bradley Manning Support Organization, the EFF, the ACLU, CARE, American Red Cross, Amnesty International, Greenpeace, some commies, some prisoners, various occupations, and many more unnamed homies. Only 9,561 of the cards were still valid. Let's now take a closer look at the events leading up to Antisec's mothership hack. Total mayhem. On December 4th, Hiria, a member of a small hacker crew called Revolusec, which worked on infiltrating Syrian government computers, among other projects, reached out to Sabu. Hiria, wake up. Got funny shit you will love. Sabu, I'm here, brother. What's up? Hiria, so I hacks this intelligence company? By accident? This immediately piqued Sabu's interest. Sabu, we would love to penetrate their users/network for pound Antisec. Definitely get me details so I can begin working. Hiria, the network is on hold right now. Soon as I extract what I need, I give it to you. But I'd advise to own them and sniff for a few months. My own country's secret services use their services. CNN uses them, etc. The Economist, LOL. The next day, Hiria provided, as Jeremy Hammond later related to me, the entire Antisec channel a link to Stratfor order databases, including addresses and credit cards and random credit card numbers swiped from the Stratfor database. Sabu created another channel called #!SEC, and Hiria delivered the information about the exploit. Hammond described the hack to me in great technical detail, though it's not essential to understanding the story. No password, oops, which lets you download the entire database dump, from MySQL database access. Here I am able to insert users into Stratfor's Drupal system, creating an administrator account, then enabling PHP code on Drupal articles, and inserting a PHP backdoor into a Drupal article, allowing remote code execution on Stratfor's web server. They kept different boxes for various services, then rooted the web server, then was able to log onto their mail server using an Autobot user that had access to several of their other internal servers for backup purposes, rooted that too. As if having no password protection was not negligent enough, Stratfor's credit card information was saved in clear text instead of behind a digital fortress of encryption, as is standard industry practice. Apparently, while Stratfor sold security briefings to its clients, it did not seem to follow any of its own advice. Antisec intended to liberate 8 years of emails from Stratfor's servers, more than 200 gigabytes. Finding a good place to put it, with enough space and bandwidth, was a bit of an issue. Hammond opted to hack some other machines to provide this service. A few other Antisec members began researching methods toward deeper infiltration into Stratfor's systems, while some who had only wanted to ignite the fire soon departed. Hiria's role was as a messenger alone, and he eventually bailed on the rest of the operation. Hiria, also another thing, when I get you the details, please forget that it came from me and that Revolusec had anything to do with it. As this company is full of crazy feds, and we don't need the credit. Sabu. Yep. Pound Antisec has been to war with feds/NATO since June. On Christmas Eve, I received a query from a mysterious user named Ghost, another incarnation of Hammond himself, as I later learned. He gave me the most explosive news I would receive in all my time studying Anonymous. Ghost. Hello. Shit's getting owned on Anonops. Biela. Hello. Ghost. About to RM-RF a major target. I was not sure what he meant by the first statement, but the second was clear. I may be no technology wizard, but I knew what RM-RF was, having been a Linux user for over 14 years. Once you have root access, this command can delete everything on the system. Technically speaking, Hammond conveyed his actions in shorthand because newer Unix systems have protections built in, such as requiring the no preserve root flag to be passed first, making it harder to delete everything by accidentally typing 6 characters. I tried to play it cool. I still wasn't sure what he was talking about. He gave me a few more details. Ghost. It is a major intelligence corporation. About 30 minutes. Biela. Okay. Ghost. Meanwhile, credit cards being used on Anonops. Soon, my confusion was cleared up by tweets like the following from Sabu. Stratford.com. Hashtag Antisec dismantles a multi-million-dollar intelligence corporation. Watch the video and read the essay. Hashtag Antisec. I thought to myself, holy sweet birth of the baby Jesus, this is really happening. A handful of people were livid or confused, but most seemed to be riding the wave with trolling slash humorous responses on the public channels. Voting still going on for LOL's Christmas donation pick. Options are, in order of leading to losing, cancer, Tor, AIDS, WikiLeaks, shelters, Red Cross, Anonops. Antisec replaced Stratfor's webpage with The Coming Insurrection, a revolutionary tract written by the Radical Anonymous Invisible Committee. Its ostensibly French authors, seeking to hasten the demise of capitalism, call for new modes of collective association and the rapid deployment of an effective guerrilla war that restores us to our ungovernability, our primordial unruliness. From Christmas Day through to New Year's, the pace of hacking redoubled. Pursuant of a generalized sort of mayhem, Antisec thought it necessary to thrash more than just a single organization. While news coverage focused almost exclusively on Stratfor, Antisec had in fact carried out a coast-to-coast hacking bonanza, and announced as much, proudly, in their zine. On New Year's Eve, while revolutionary comrades brought the noise to the front of jails across the world in support of the incarcerated, we were opening fire on the websites and emails of the 1%, publishing stolen information from police departments in both California and New York. From coast to coast, we lulled as we hit the top police chiefs, skimming their private email and Facebook accounts, blissfully abusing their internal law enforcement portals, and making off quick with their private documents, which we then published on Tor Hidden Services and BitTorrent. Finally, we defaced their websites and RM'd their servers, live on IRC and Twitter for the whole world to see. Antisec's 3 additional targets were CSLEA.com, the California Statewide Law Enforcement Association, self-touted, it is worth noting, as America's most fascinating law enforcement association, nychiefs.org, New York State Association of Chiefs of Police, and specialforces.com, a marketplace for, as the name may suggest, gear oriented toward special forces operations. Each site added to the growing Antisec collection of mail spools, usernames, passwords, emails, phone numbers, and law enforcement-sensitive documents. The whole while, Sabu remained unflappably brazen and ferocious. In reply to an ex-supporter who blamed Antisec for being irresponsible, he bit back, "Fuck the intelligence community, the security industry, and everyone in between. We support the people." He painted Stratfor as the criminals. At Stratfor has potentially broken the law by storing customer data unencrypted on a publicly accessible insecure server. Question them. The internal accusations and suspicions of Sabu were mitigated by moments like these. But accusations persisted. A few pastebin announcements surfaced on the subject. One was entitled, "Press Release, Stratfor Hack, Not Anonymous," and chided Sabu, "Sabu and his crew are nothing more than opportunistic attention whores who are possibly agent provocateurs." Just a few weeks prior to LOL's Christmas, Sabu had finally agreed to meet with Brian Knappenberger to be filmed for his documentary, but only if certain conditions were met. Sabu was to be concealed and his voice distorted, and Knappenberger was to leave no digital trace of his travels or whereabouts. He would have to get to New York City by paying for his airline ticket and hotel in cash, making sure to choose a hotel or place to sleep where ID was not required. I was away for the holidays and returned to New York City, and a relentless downpour, on December 26th, expressly to assist Knappenberger and help him connect with Sabu. But Sabu never showed. However, given the major hacks that had just occurred, Sabu's absence seemed more like an indication that he was being careful, rather than chickening out. The next day, and despite the no-show, I decided to make one last effort to see Sabu. I wanted to give him a small gift before I left New York City, the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. I went downstairs and called Sabu, asking whether he would come by the next day to pick it up before my partner and I left for Canada. After the wet and miserable failures of the day before, I had serious doubts that he would show up. But Sabu did not disappoint. As my partner and I sat in our car, just minutes before our planned departure time, a huge black pickup truck loaded with guys rolled up, and Sabu hopped out. I went out to meet him. He was in a rush, and we were too, so our exchange lasted less than 10 minutes. I gave him the book and wished him well. He walked over to our car, and my partner rolled down the window. I introduced them, avoiding, as per protocol, any reference to Sabu or any other name. He never offered his real one. They shook hands as our scruffy dog looked on. It was the last time I would see Sabu in person. Back to the classics. Anonymous activity would soar to new heights over the next 3 months. Antisec was still sitting on the full Stratfor email spool, providing nibbles here and there in taunting press releases. Meanwhile, Barrett Brown continued to beg for the emails, and relations between him and the crew became tense. Hammond explained that some Antisec members at the time did not like B.B. Brown for many of the same personality ego-tripping reasons that are already well known. A few were especially upset that he had tweeted about the release before it was made public. They decided to give the cash to WikiLeaks. Hammond simply went to the WikiLeaks IRC server, largely behind Sabu's back, and the deal was done. When talking to WikiLeaks, Hammond recounted to me, they first asked to authenticate the leak by pasting them some samples, which I did, but they didn't ask who I was or even really how I got access to it. But I told them voluntarily that I was working with Antisec and had hacked Stratfor. Soon after, he arranged the handoff. When Sabu found out, he insisted on dealing with Assange personally. After all, he told Hammond, he was already in contact with Assange's trusted assistant, Q. Later, Wired.com's Kevin Paulson broke a story about Q, an Icelandic teenager, Sigurdur Siggi Thordarson, who voluntarily became an FBI informant in August 2011, handing thousands of WikiLeaks chats and documents over to law enforcement in the process. He did it, reportedly, for the adventure. Sabu entered into conversations with WikiLeaks about getting some cash for the leaks, according to Hammond. But by that time, WikiLeaks already had the documents and were well on their way to processing them for release. In just 2 months, the public would see the emails for themselves. As the hubbub over the credit card donations simmered down around mid-January, the populist face of Anonymous re-emerged in reaction to the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA. The far-reaching U.S. copyright bill was unpopular, and not only among civil libertarians. The digerati and Silicon Valley elite also came out against it. SOPA called for, among other things, Google and other search engines to prevent flagged sites like the Pirate Bay from showing up in search results. A massive and elaborate outpouring of dissent ensured the bill's unraveling well before it could pass into law. The linchpin was a blackout day held on January 18, 2012, a web-based protest of unprecedented scale. A handful of large internet companies, several public interest groups, and thousands of individuals programmed their websites to display only black, with links urging visitors to write their representatives to express opposition to SOPA. Around 75,000 web pages went dark, including dozens of prominent corporate and nonprofit websites such as Wikipedia, Flickr, Wired, 4chan, and Google. Journalists also wrote a torrent of articles. Less than a week later, SOPA and its Senate counterpart, PIPA, were effectively scrapped by being tabled indefinitely. In the end, CBS News described the number of participants as staggering. 4.5 million people signed a petition circulated by Google. 350,000 citizens wrote to their representatives via SOPASTRIKE.com and AmericanCensorship.org. Over 2.4 million SOPA-related tweets were written on January 18th alone, and an online White House petition garnered 103,785 names. In response to the petition, the government officially announced the bill's demise. "Moving forward, we will continue to work with Congress on a bipartisan basis on legislation that provides new tools needed in the global fight against piracy and counterfeiting, while vigorously defending an open internet based on the values of free expression, privacy, security, and innovation." Corporate giants like Google, respected internet personalities like Wikipedia co-founder Jimmy Wales, and civil liberties organizations like the EFF were all integral to the victory. But the grassroots geek and hacker contingent was also present, including, of course, Anonymous. They churned out videos and propaganda posters and provided constant updates on several prominent Twitter accounts. When the blackout ended, corporate players quickly receded from the limelight. Anonymous and others, however, continued the seemingly endless fight. Just the next day, in fact, on January 19th, 2012, federal authorities orchestrated the takedown of popular file-sharing site Mega Upload. The company's gregarious and controversial founder, Kim.com, was arrested in a dramatic early morning raid in New Zealand. The removal of this popular website was received ominously by Anonymous activists. Although SOPA had nothing to do with .com's arrest, it was a reminder of the enormous regulatory power that copyright industries could wield over web content, with or without formal legal backing. Even though no court had yet found .com guilty of piracy, his property was confiscated and his website knocked off the internet. While .com's case is still ongoing at the time of writing, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, John Key, has issued a formal apology for illegal surveillance leading up to the dramatic raid on .com's house, which involved 2 helicopters and 76 officers. As soon as the news broke, Anonymous retaliated with its largest DDoS campaign to date, downing the homepages of Universal Music, the FBI, the U.S. Copyright Office, the Recording Industry Association of America, and the Motion Picture Association of America, among others. Entities all which sought to stamp out illegal file sharing. Anonymous and AnonOps changed up their tactics, opting for a different tool than Loic. This new tool, called Pylorus, was both more cleverly designed and also more powerful. Most importantly, it protected the privacy of its user. It worked by making an incomplete connection to the target server and then holding it open for a very long time. Normally, a server has only so many available slots for accepting connections. But if the connection is only partially set up, the slot will wait, refusing subsequent connections in the interim. With enough people making and maintaining these incomplete connections, the server's available slots become filled, and service is effectively denied. It all unfolded like the best old-school ops, with the software available to download from a link in the IRC channel topic, and the targets announced to the channel for the several thousand people who opted into the attack. Links also pointed to guides on how to better anonymize one's connections using Tor and VPNs. Just a few weeks later, in Europe, as massive online and offline demonstrations unfolded against the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, ACTA, another international copyright agreement, Anonymous again appeared. Following the Polish government's agreement to ratify ACTA, Anonymous took down a slew of their websites and began to heavily publicize the street protests sweeping Krakow. Soon after, Poland's left-leaning Palikots movement party donned Guy Fawkes masks during a parliamentary hearing on ACTA, the first and so far the only time elected officials adopted the revolutionary symbol. Amid this and many other outcries, the European Parliament rejected the proposed law in July 2012. Afterwards, one of the old guard Anons, who had been a member of Pound Command as far back as the fall of 2010, reached out to me with the following assessment. H. At the moment, it seems as if there is a whole new group of people, not connected to hashtag anti-sec and working as hard as ever, which makes me happy and proud of people. Biela. Yeah, here and a few other places. It is good. H. And when I saw those Polish politicians with masks on? Biela. Yeah, unreal. H. I realized that us bunch of motley fools have actually entered the world's consciousness and, in some small way, are changing things. As an insider, it's natural that he would seek to puff up Anonymous. But that wasn't all that was going on. His assessment of the group's increasing power seemed accurate. Not long after this exchange, I received a call from a venture capitalist who had helped organize some of the protests against SOPA. He wanted to learn more about how Anonymous operated behind the scenes. The group seemed to pop up unpredictably, he remarked, before musing on the possibility that an outsider was contacting and harnessing it toward other fights for internet freedom. It felt a bit gross. One of Anonymous's core principles is that it will not be anybody's personal army. But if nothing else, his interest demonstrated the accuracy of H's intuition. Anonymous had become an important, recognized, and potent component of the global political mix. Admit nothing, deny everything, and make counter-accusations. On February 27th, WikiLeaks distributed the Stratfor emails, labeling them the Global Intelligence Files. Opinions over their political significance varied. A small cohort of journalists, security specialists, and even some of Stratfor's own customers reacted with a mere meh. Scant evidence of outrageous or illegal behavior was contained in the emails, they asserted. This blasé reaction was colored by the less-than-stellar reputation already enjoyed by Stratfor at the time of the release. Many viewed the company, frankly, as rip-off artists. Stratfor is a joke, and so is WikiLeaks for taking it seriously, was the insulting headline proffered by Max Fisher in The Atlantic. For an exorbitant fee, up to $40,000 per annum in 2001, Stratfor subscribers received a newsletter, which Fisher said contained little more than rehashed news. Of course, the firm's reputation only plunged further when it was revealed it never bothered to encrypt its subscribers' credit card information. Other journalists and members of the public found the emails to be politically potent, however, providing solid nuggets of proof that Stratfor profited from morally dubious practices, such as corporate propaganda dressed as public relations and the monitoring of activists. The Stratfor emails are indeed revealing, and occasionally prescient. Take, for instance, the following excerpt from a lengthier email, typed, remarkably, on an iPhone on December 10, 2010. The Channers/Anon/B are educated and at the leading edge of network-based technology, have a nebulous structure of loyal people spread through the world with no nationalistic foundations, but drawn together under a shared interest in chaos, hentai and cats, for fuck's sake. There are numerous examples where they have uncovered identities and all personal details of people based on a single photo, of a woman putting a cat in a garbage bin, for example, and brought some serious vigilante-style justice to those they disagree with. It's going to be very interesting to watch what Anon does in the post-WikiLeaks environment. If they move from a bunch of tech geeks in Mum's basement into a real movement, they could cause serious trouble and be hard to kill. The core is not the problem, but the few unhinged among them could prove to be quite destructive if so inclined. Journalist Steve Horn sifted through thousands of Stratfor emails and wrote a two-part series examining the tactics deployed by the firm and its predecessors, Mongevin, Biscoe, and Dutchin, MBD, and Pagan. The founder of MBD, Ronald Dutchin, a military man with extensive work experience in public relations, devised the Dutchin formula. Isolate the radicals, cultivate the idealists, and educate them into becoming realists. Then co-opt the realists in agreeing with industry. Horn notes that this strategy is still employed to this day by Stratfor. The majority of company emails show that the most important service Stratfor provides is its sociological analysis in service to corporate power and capital, not the dirty-on-the-ground work, according to Horn. A smattering of emails also point to more direct involvement in the monitoring of activists. A 1984 explosion at a Union Carbide India Limited plant in Bhopal, India, one of the worst industrial disasters of the 20th century, left thousands dead and over 500,000 exposed to deadly chemicals. Dow Chemical, who purchased Union Carbide, hired Stratfor to keep tabs on various activist groups, such as the Yes Men and Bhopal Medical Appeal, which were publicizing the issue or assisting victims. The documents revealed that Coca-Cola hired Stratfor to watch the environmental group PETA, particularly its operations in Canada, in the lead-up to the Vancouver Olympics. And Stratfor sent an employee, self-described in an email as UC, undercover, to infiltrate the local Occupy group in Austin, Texas, with the goal of gathering organizational intelligence, tracking the occupiers' movements, and identifying possible ties with environmental activists. There's a group you may be familiar with called Deep Green Resistance. Whether anyone in the Fed or elsewhere classifies this group as eco-terror or not, I don't know, but they are nothing but, and should be watched. The local Austin chapter was part of the Occupy Austin crowd at City Hall. However, things were not radical enough for them, since they do not believe in working within the system. When I was working undercover on November 5th, some of my contacts told me that at the General Assembly on November 4th, there was some conflict between regular Occupy people and Deep Green. These examples harken back to the issues raised in Chapter 7 regarding the H.B. Gary and H.B. Gary federal emails, which, among other suggestions, both creepy and invasive, contained a proposal to discredit WikiLeaks. Information about corporate espionage, even with these emails, is still scant. Still, between emerging examples of abuse and the difficulty in accessing corporate records, we should, at a minimum, be troubled by cozy ties revealed between private industry and government. If indeed, as one email purports, Stratfor's Vice President of Intelligence, Fred Burton, lives by the code, admit nothing, deny everything, and make counter-accusations, then we can see the importance of the leaks and whistleblowing activities of Anonymous and its ilk. Stratfor issued this statement about the authenticity of the leaked emails. Some of the emails may be forged or altered to include inaccuracies. Some may be authentic. We will not validate either, nor will we explain the thinking that went into them. Having had our property stolen, we will not be victimized twice by submitting to questioning about them. Stratfor did, however, comment on two emails that were subsequently widely accepted as frauds. A letter of resignation from Stratfor's founder, CIO, and CEO, George Friedman, which Antisec wrote, and a fraudulent email purportedly sent to all Stratfor customers offering a free subscription to the company's newsletter as a peace offering and apology for the breach. I needed the truth out there. Around this time, Sabu became more cocky and defiant in public than ever. In early February, in response to a critic asking about the status of Syrian emails that Antisec was rumored to have, Sabu barked, "You'll eat your words once we decide to leak what we have. We don't give a fuck about governments. We give a fuck about people." I had not talked to him on the phone since moving to Canada. This wasn't only due to the logistics of moving. Calling from an outdoor payphone in the middle of a Montreal winter put one at risk of frostbite. But early in the morning on March 6th, Sabu kept harassing me on Twitter. He didn't care how I contacted him, as long as I did it, and as soon as possible. I picked up my home phone and called him. It was as if he started talking before even picking up the phone. "Fox is going to publish a story about me in the FBI. Sabu explained that the story was slated to go live in just a few minutes. He said that he wanted to explain some things before I read it. Distraught, he said that Fox had stooped so low to get at him and his family, but he refused to tell me just what they had done. He said only, "It's not what you think it is." My head spun throughout it all. I grew dizzy. I remember being angry and having difficulty verbalizing what I was feeling or remembering what he said. And then, somehow, the conversation ended. As it turned out, there was not one but three stories about Hector Xavier Monsiger, each featuring a giant picture of his face as he sat in front of a computer. There it was, Sabu's cooperation with the FBI. This is what he had been trying to tell me on the phone. I was dumbstruck. The news coincided with a string of indictments also detailed in the articles. In the U.S., the FBI had just arrested Jeremy Hammond, while in the U.K. and Ireland, Ryan Aykroyd, Kayla, Donica O'Carroll, Palladium, and Darren Martin, Own Sauce, were each indicted on computer conspiracy charges. The news rolled through the different IRC channels like a shockwave. The Cabin Crew channel hosted a number of people who were very close to Sabu. Pseudonyms have been altered. Round Eyes. "Comrade, front page of Fox News. Now. Comma. K." Round Eyes. "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God." Flava Flav. "Damn. I didn't know. Wow. Fucking Sabu. Guys, may I speak for 1 minute? Nacho King. Go. Mega. No. LOL. JK. Go on. Comrade. LOL. Flava Flav. We should frame this as a defining moment, like Libya after Gaddafi. We are free of a burden, a dead weight, clouding everything we were and will be. Mega. Well, he was never a burden to begin with, in my opinion. Comrade. Yeah, that's strangely not comforting right now, Flava Flav. Flava Flav. And from here on. Mega. Why not, comrade? Flava Flav. You're missing my point. He was a phase, and now. Comrade. LOL. Flava Flav. Is a new one. Comrade. Okay. I can go with phase. Flava Flav. It's an evolutionary process. Nacho King. Right, I'm just saying, Flava Flav. A lot of people are reacting in a bunch of different ways. Nacho King was right. While everyone felt the bitter sting of betrayal, a minority still supported Sabu. The Fox News article had indeed reported that the FBI dangled a time-honored ultimatum in front of Sabu. He could work for the G-Men or have his adopted cousins forcibly removed from his care. Eventually, a number of former anonymous participants, more hangers-on than hardcore hackers, told me that Sabu had been telling them back in the summer of 2011 to get the fuck out. It started to become clear why Sabu had been cozying up with the Anons who possessed the hacking skills to enter systems and not bothering with those who weren't breaking the law. He was targeting those of most interest to the FBI. A few hours later, a dominant attitude was emerging on the channels, one which echoed the sentiment of an unnamed government official quoted in the Fox report. You might be a messiah in the hacking community, but you're still a rat. By the end of the day, Sabu's reputation within Anonymous was irrevocably tarnished, and as the news reverberated throughout the intertubes, howls of anger and pangs of betrayal sounded. It took a month before my own anger had receded enough that I could have another conversation with him. He was at his most defiant, opening our conversation with the salvo that he was disappointed that no one questioned the news report. Then he growled in disbelief at being treated like a biohazard. "I protected hundreds of people," he insisted. "I saved a lot of asses. When you have kids, you have to choose. I did the right thing." His only plea for sympathy concerned the fact that he himself faced penalties. He had been arrested, after all, and maintained his liberty only on bail. It remained likely that he would still face 10 or 15 years in prison. "Not knowing one's fate is stressful," he declared. When I asked him how much of what he did and said was directed by the FBI, he barked, "Everything I said on Twitter was my motherfucking point of view." He added later, "I was genuine with my tweets. No one dictated what I wrote." This directly contradicts statements made by one of his handlers, as reported by Jenna Winter for Fox News. "About 90% of what you see online is bullsh," said the handler, in reference both to posts from Sabu's Twitter account and also interviews he gave to the press. "Whether this is the truth or an even more elaborate, recursive disinformation campaign, the implication is that Sabu parroted whatever the FBI wanted him to say. There were some tweets. If, God forbid, I am arrested, I'll admit to my crimes and take myself down. I do not believe in bringing others down for my own sins. Thanks." That we now know were unadulterated nuggets of FBI-influenced BS. I barely got a word in edgewise, but I did manage to ask Sabu whether he met me at the behest of the FBI. His voice became louder in dismissal. "Jesus Christ, you don't need to ask permission to go to fucking Chipotle and get a burrito?" Unsatisfied, I asked him again why he reached out to me, and I asked a further question about the catalyst of our meeting, the hacker at the NYSEC meetup. He began brushing this off, but suddenly stopping short. "I needed the truth out there one way or another," he stated clearly. "The more time we spent, the more I felt I could confide in you. It is a shitty situation." He let loose one final deluge of vitriol. "I expected the nerds to expose my family, but not the media. For the media to post shit on my family?" He added, "There are many informants in Anonymous." Then he wrapped up with some shout-outs, giving props to Jeremy and Donica, two of the most technically savvy and hard-working hackers in Anonymous, who had themselves refused to offer anything to law enforcement, and whose capture had largely been the result of his actions. Then he offered a few parting words. "I still think the idea of Anonymous is beautiful. Decentralization is power." Lawbreaking and snitches. Around this time, Anonymous participants and some independent journalists like Nigel Perry began raising questions about the official story that had coalesced around the Stratfor hack. On March 25th, 2012, Perry penned a detailed blog post titled "Sacrificing Stratfor: How the FBI Waited 3 Weeks to Close the Stable Door." He noted how bizarre it was that Stratfor's thorough owning could occur right under the FBI's nose. After all, the FBI maintained, both in court documents and the Fox reporter, that Monsiger was on the tightest of leashes the whole time. "The FBI," wrote Jana Winter, "has had an agent watching his online activity 24 hours a day," officials said. Monsiger provided the FBI with direct, real-time access to unfolding developments, and the FBI informed Stratfor of the intrusion almost immediately, in early December. Antisec only had access to the customer database at this time. It took another 10 days for Hammond to infiltrate the rest of the system. Hammond didn't delete the data for another 10 days, on Christmas Eve. Stratfor had ample opportunity to step up its security, or, if nothing else, back up its data. But it did not. In the aftermath of this hacking blitz, George Friedman, Stratfor's CEO, provided the following vague explanation. "We work to improve our security infrastructure within the confines of time and the desire to protect the investigation by not letting the attackers know that we knew of their intrusion." By November 2013, publicly accessible court records had confirmed Hammond's timeline. And yet, for over 2 years, no other journalist had bothered to press Stratfor on its failure to take yet additional protective measures after the initial intrusion. Nor did they question why the FBI waited until December 24th to deliver Stratfor a second wave of bad tidings, that emails had been downloaded and data was being wiped, when it knew full well that AntiSec had gained wider access days earlier. The FBI's rationalization for its actions does little to clarify the situation. As Nicole Pearl Roth of the New York Times reported, the FBI said that it immediately notified Stratfor, but said that at that point it was too late. Over the next several weeks, hackers rummaged through Stratfor's financial information, email correspondence, and subscribers' personal and financial information, occasionally deleting its most valuable data, all in full view of FBI agents. Then, in May 2014, an astonishing bevy of court documents, chat logs, surveillance photos, and government documents from Hammond's court case were leaked to journalists Del Cameron and Daniel Stuckey. Armed with them, they were able to corroborate Hammond's timeline at a more granular level. The chat logs in particular go a long way toward confirming, as Cameron wrote, long-standing accusations that federal investigators allowed an informant to repeatedly break computer crime laws while in pursuit of Hammond and other anonymous figures. Allegations that Sabu aided and abetted illegal activity. Recall that it was Sabu who brought the Stratfor vulnerability to Hammond in the first place, were not limited to the Stratfor hack. During Hammond's sentencing hearing in November 2014, he read a statement that included another explosive accusation. "After Stratfor, I continued to break into other targets, using a powerful zero-day exploit, allowing me administrator access to systems running the popular Plesk web hosting platform. Sabu asked me many times for access to this exploit, which I refused to give him. Without his own independent access, Sabu continued to supply me with lists of vulnerable targets. I broke into numerous websites he supplied, uploaded the stolen email accounts and databases onto Sabu's FBI server, and handed over passwords and backdoors that enabled Sabu, and by extension, his FBI handlers, to control these targets. These intrusions, all of which were suggested by Sabu while cooperating with the FBI, affected thousands of domain names and consisted largely of foreign government websites, including Brazil, Turkey, Syria." As Hammond was about to mention more government targets, Judge Preska implored him, "Mr. Hammond, we just spoke about those countries being redacted. I'd appreciate if you didn't use them." In his statement, Hammond also reminded the court of the existence of some evidence backing his claims. "All of this happened under the control and supervision of the FBI and can be easily confirmed by chat logs the government provided to us pursuant to the government's discovery obligations in the case against me. Because I pled guilty, I do not have access to many documents that might have been provided to me in advance of trial, such as Sabu's communications with the FBI. In addition, the majority of the documents provided to me are under a protective order, which insulates this material from public scrutiny." Hammond's statement was republished online, with some websites redacting the names of the countries mentioned and others including them. "Having been told about these hacks earlier, during my first prison visit, I became intrigued about how much truth might lie behind Hammond's claims. I raised these questions to some journalists and convinced one to track them down. Eventually, this culminated in a front-page New York Times story by Mark Mazzetti in late April 2014, entitled, 'FBI Informant is Tied to Cyber Attacks Abroad.' Then, after the trove of court documents under protective order were leaked, journalists Daniel Stuckey and Andrew Blake wrote a detailed play-by-play of Sabu's role in orchestrating hacks against the Brazilian government and various corporate websites. Although many of Sabu's targets were threaded through Hammond, he also offered vulnerabilities to other hackers. In one documented case, he offered a valuable exploit, which, opened back doors to hundreds of Brazilian websites. And all of this was performed under the FBI's careful gaze. The news that the FBI allowed, or at least abided, Sabu's role in facilitating an illegal hacking spree struck many an anonymous as a perverse abuse of power. Of course, we don't know, and likely never will, whether Sabu's services were loaned out by the FBI to other three-letter agencies for military ops or intelligence gathering, whether his actions furthered the government's own purposes in some roundabout way, or whether other factors were at work. But when this example is contextualized within the broader American informant system, it becomes clear that the scenario is far from unusual. Law professor Alexandra Natapoff argues that corrupt relations between informants and their handlers are not sporadic, exceptional activities. They are endemic. In her book Snitching, Criminal Informants and the Erosion of American Justice, she persuasively illustrates a twisted system that often results in increased cycles of crime and violence. The FBI routinely allows its informants to break the law, Natapoff argues, so long as they are otherwise cooperative. While informants are a necessary tool for the criminal justice system, she concludes that in the program's present configuration, informant use inflicts significant wounds on the integrity of the criminal process. Natapoff and other journalists have documented numerous cases of abuse. For instance, in 2005, Yassin Wasif, a part-time engineering student living in the Bay Area, was escorted off a plane in Paris headed for San Francisco. Despite holding a green card and not being under investigation, he was interrogated for hours in a U.S. Customs and Border Protection facility. Ultimately, an FBI agent offered a choice: become an informant in the Muslim American community or face deportation to his home country, Morocco. A lawsuit filed in April 2014 on behalf of four Muslim men alleges that the FBI placed or kept them on a no-fly list after they refused to spy on Muslim communities in New York, New Jersey, and Nebraska. This sort of bullying aims to intervene directly into a community, changing its very nature without having formally established any wrongdoing. The majority of cases involving informants never go to trial in the United States, so we only learn about this system and are able to argue for its reform thanks to occasional trials and leaks, a reminder of how the Hammond court case leak can serve the democratic process. The fact that Sabu was allowed to facilitate so many hacks under full view of the FBI is testament to the ongoing abuses of the informant system. It also serves as a painful reminder that the state will use methods, both legal and illegal, to dismantle a movement deemed threatening. Trust no one on IRC ever. As the news rumbled about Sabu's informant status, it became apparent that while Monsiger's cooperation had made a decisive difference, many participants had neglected to properly secure their information. Anonymous 9 expressed it to me this way: "The fact that people got arrested because of him is partially because he was a traitor, and partially because those people were careless. If they hadn't shared personal information with him, they would have been fine." Sort of comes back to the whole trust no one on IRC ever thing. It may be hard to prove computer crimes after they have been committed unless data, such as credit card numbers, emails, or other incriminating information, is found on a subject's computer. But as computer security researcher Robert Graham put it, chat logs culled by an informant can be used to convict you of conspiracy, intent, obstruction of justice, and racketeering. And the prosecution had an enormous hunk of logs from which to build its case. Still, having Sabu around was not enough to nab everyone. Some members of Antisec and Lulsec remain out of reach of the law. Had others been more careful with their operational security, they may never have been caught. How were mistakes made? Hammond practiced nearly flawless technical operational security, but in chats he revealed personal details. The most significant, which I had seen him mention once in public and once in a private channel, was that he had spent time in federal prison. Given one of his main nicknames, Anarchaos, his unique status as one of the only bona fide American anarchist hackers to have done time in U.S. prison must have placed him pretty high on the list of candidates. Perhaps the one vital task that Sabu performed for the FBI here was to connect Hammond's potpourri of different nicknames. Below is a snippet of a conversation filed in the court documents between Sabu, as CW1, and Hammond, as at Supji, on Christmas Day. CW1. How's the news looking? At Supji. I've been going hard all night. CW1. I heard we're all over the newspapers. You motherfuckers are going to get me raided. Ha 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 ha. At Supji. We put out 30K cards, the it.stratfor.com dump, and another statement. Dude, it's big. CW1. If I get raided, NR Chaos, your job is to cause havoc in my honor. At Supji. It shall be so. Of course, Sabu proved crucial to the investigations in many other ways. One LulzSec member shared a link to a homebrewed video he hosted on YouTube. With the URL, the authorities sent a subpoena to YouTube for the account's email address, and from there it was trivial to connect his Facebook account. This young hacker had made the grave mistake of uploading incriminating screenshots of a web defacement, which were then shared with another member of LulzSec, Oy Vey. Anonymous 9's suggestion to trust no one on IRC is much easier said than done. The sabotage, as one person humorously referred to it, cut so deep because Anonymous, like almost every political movement, was underwritten by friendships and the flourishing of more intimate relationships still. Marriages, like the one between the young hacker John Anthony Burrell III, Kahuna, from the cabin crew, and Sarah Burrell, were indebted to chats in the crew's private IRC channel. Topiary shepherded one of his LulzSec mates through a dark period of his life. Even those who never shared personally identifying information were interpolated into strong, lasting bonds. Such connections make it all too tempting and easy to be lulled into a state of comfort wherein one betrays their identity by oversharing. Even if one recognizes that this is happening, it is not as simple as simply changing a nickname, scrubbing all markers of the previous identity, and adopting a different style of talk. Parmi Olsen highlights this dilemma constantly faced by hackers. Changing a nickname means losing the stable marker of identity and reputation crucial to hacker co-working across time. A few years later, I asked some Anons why, given creeping suspicions that he was an informant, Sabu was not only tolerated, but actually advanced as anti-sex public-facing persona. For O'Carroll, one of the other anti-sec Anons, his charisma did the trick. Like no one else, he was able to rouse public passion with his clarion calls for uprising. Another plausible explanation was advanced by numerous other participants. Another figure, Yeti, not his real pseudonym, was himself, for much of the time, a target of copious snitching accusations, which drew attention away from Sabu. At least a dozen core participants had shared with me their fears about Yeti. He had managed to gain access to countless IRC servers and was known for playing with many people's minds, including, I felt, my own. Even Hammond, momentarily operating under the handle Credible Threat, called him to the mat in an uncommon public display of internal strife in the fall of 2011. Credible Threat. Hey, Yeti, did you tell everybody about how and why you were kicked out of anti-sec core team? Where were you for all these months? Why the fuck should anyone trust you again, snitch? To this day, no one can definitively say whether Yeti is an informant or merely creepy. Many others were also accused. Rumors like these are endlessly analyzed in light of what is deemed odd behavior and the scant factual information available to participants. For instance, leaked law enforcement documents name a CW2, confidential witness to, implying that there were at least two informants milling around. Many participants also asked why some hackers and participants embedded in the secret channels were never raided or questioned once they decided to go public. These rumors and uncertainties propel the stormy and disorienting atmospherics of paranoia so common in the context of leftist or progressive political movements. Once the fog of fear and confusion settles, it makes it difficult to sort out paranoia from reality, imaginary enemies from perfectly real ones, in the words of Ruth Rosen, who chronicled FBI-induced fear in the 1960s women's liberation movement. Sabu's outing also functioned as a test, pushing Anonymous into a period of introspection. For weeks, as Anons wailed, raged, assessed, reassessed, and freaked out on Twitter and various IRC networks, they wondered what future, if any, remained for Anonymous after such a blow. Would it come to pass, to quote an Anonymous government official featured in Winter's Fox News article, that when people in the hacking community realize their God has actually been in cooperation with the government, it'll be sheer terror? Knock, knock, we're here. While the sabotage fanned the flames of paranoia, it did not spell the end of Anonymous, or even really cultivate a substantial amount of terror. Even if Anonymous could never replicate the high participant levels of its lulsec/antisec days, back when Fox News' description of them as hackers on steroids was apt, Anonymous carried along just fine through 2012 and much of 2013, executing major hacks and attacks across the world. Its formidable reputation is best illustrated by an anecdote from the highest echelons of U.S. officialdom. In 2012, Barack Obama's re-election campaign team assembled a group of programmers, system administrators, mathematicians, and data scientists to fine-tune voter targeting. Journalists praised Obama's star-studded and maverick technology team, detailing its members' hard work, success, and travails, and ultimately heralding the system as a success. These articles, however, failed to report one of the team's big concerns. Throughout the campaign, the technologists had treated Anonymous as a potentially even bigger nuisance than the foreign state hackers who had infiltrated the McCain and Obama campaigns in 2008. In late November 2012, Asher Wolf, a geek crusader who acted as a sometimes informal advisor to Anonymous, noticed that Harper Reed, the chief technologist for Obama's re-election tech team, followed @AnoniOps on Twitter. Much like a trickster, Wolf pointed this out to AnoniOps, suggesting, "Let's play with that and see what we can do." AnoniOps sent Reed a private Twitter message. "Hi. The next few months are big. I thought we should maybe chat." Reed read the message and his heart sank, as he explained it to me in an interview. He reached out to his boss, the chief information officer, and the head of security for the Obama campaign. They hammered out a variety of possible 140-character replies. Finally, they hit on this bit of genius. "Hey, what's on your mind?" As Harper was about to send the message, the chief information officer, who had been speaking with senior lawyers for the campaign, bolted over to Harper's desk to stop him. They had changed their mind. The best response, they determined, was no response at all. He came seconds too late. Had Reed known what I did, he would have been spared a day or two of anxiety. AnoniOps was simply interested in initiating a conversation with an influential political figure. Reflecting back on the event during an interview with me, Wolf recalled that it was amusing because we were like kids playing with boundaries, with the world's superpower. We'd been through 2010 when the screens poured with rage as the administration went after WikiLeaks and we'd gone through Occupy. We'd seen people be jailed, disappear. Maybe, just maybe, we were a little fatalistic. And maybe it felt good once, just once, to wander up close to the administration that drones small children and flick a cigarette butt in their faces. As this incident shows, Anonymous had become a specter. Its influence had grown so far-reaching that it didn't even have to do anything to have an effect. It is understandable why Obama's re-election team felt perturbed by this ambiguous knock on its digital door. In the 2 months following Hammond's arrest, Anonymous hacked into hundreds of Chinese government websites, knocked the website for Formula One racing offline after the repressive government of Bahrain, set to host the next Formula One race, had detained and imprisoned protesters, and hacked into the website of the Greek finance ministry, drawing attention to the government's plan to track citizens' bank information in an effort to curtail tax fraud. Over the summer of 2012, Anonymous launched another major hack, again against the Formula One website, this time coinciding with the Montreal Grand Prix. This was done to protest Bill 78, a controversial measure passed in Quebec to curtail protest activity, which had soared after proposed tuition hikes. Quebec's Human Rights Commission issued a 56-page report condemning the bill for its flagrant violation of the province's own human rights charter, notably for the provision that threatened to fine protesters thousands of dollars if they failed to notify authorities at least 8 hours in advance of the itinerary of any protest involving 50 or more people. Later that month in India, after a Supreme Court order mandated that local ISPs block torrent websites, file-sharing websites, and even some video-sharing websites, Anonymous retaliated by DDoSing the Indian Supreme Court, the Ministry of Communications and Information Technology, the Bharatiya Janata Party, and the Indian National Congress. Like many Anons, AnonOps India took to Twitter to make its views heard. We will become a hashtag pain in the hashtag ass for the government until they stop hashtag censoring our hashtag internet. It belongs to us. Anonymous continued unabated in 2013, remaining committed to ongoing issues, as in Pound Op Last Resort, a series of retributive hacks carried out against the websites of MIT, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the U.S. Sentencing Commission following the suicide of internet pioneer and activist Aaron Swartz. His family and many admirers felt that his suicide at age 26 was a political act born out of a sense of desperation fueled by his impending trial. Swartz faced 35 years in jail and $1 million in fines, simply for downloading a cache of academic journal articles he never released. Aaron's death is the product of a criminal justice system rife with intimidation and prosecutorial overreach, wrote his family and partner. In the video accompanying their hacks and website defacements, Anonymous echoed this assessment. 2 weeks ago today, a line was crossed. 2 weeks ago today, Aaron Swartz was killed. Killed because he faced an impossible choice. Killed because he was forced into playing a game he could not win. A twisted and distorted perversion of justice. A game where the only winning move was not to play. While initially receiving scant media attention, a trio of North American ops focusing on a recent spate of sexual assault and rape allegations hooked American newsmakers. Suddenly, Anonymous was back on center stage. Once again in its preferred position, Anonymous managed to stimulate public debate on an issue too often treated as a mere tantalizing spectacle. The first case, originating in Steubenville, Ohio, concerned two members of a high school football team facing trial for raping a classmate. The night of the assault, other team members snapped photos of and filmed the unconscious woman, promptly sharing them on social media with sickening celebratory statements. One video, eventually sent to Anonymous, featured a classmate boasting that they raped her harder than that cop raped Marcellus Wallace in Pulp Fiction. That's how you know she's dead, because someone pissed on her. In December 2012, while local Steubenville activist Michelle McKee asserted that a fair trial was impossible in a town that treated the football players as demigods, she reached out to Anonymous and they swooped in. An Anon who had recently taken up the handle KY Anonymous, his real name is Derek Lostutter, was at work exposing the identities of posters on revenge porn forums. Reading about the Steubenville case incensed him, and he expressed as much on Twitter. McKee sent him some incriminating material that had circulated with social media accounts of individuals linked to the event. KY Anonymous sprung into action, first releasing an ominous video warning. David Kushner memorably described it for Rolling Stone. Like a deft poker player, Lostutter amped up his manifesto with a bluff. He claimed that Anonymous had already doxed everyone involved with the cover-up and crime, parents, teachers, and kids, and were going to release their private information online unless all accused parties come forward by New Year's Day and issue a public apology to the girl and her family. By the next day, a hacker named Noah McHugh, who went by Batcat, allegedly gained access to RollRedRoll.com, the school's sports web portal, named after its buff, red, devil-like stallion mascot, and accessed team emails. KY Anonymous tweeted nonstop while celebrities like Roseanne Barr added their network effect to the cause. Then, on December 29th, a cold, wintry day, Anonymous's call for a street demonstration in Steubenville was answered by a throng of 1,000 demonstrators with a now requisite smattering of Guy Fawkes masks. In a dramatic turn, some of them spoke of their own sexual assaults and rapes, removing their masks to show themselves to the crowd, wrote Kushner. Anonymous remained hyperactively involved with the Steubenville assault on Twitter until two teenagers were found guilty of rape in May 2013. One defendant received the minimum sentence, 1 year in a juvenile correctional facility. The other was sentenced to 2 years. In November 2013, four Steubenville residents, including the school superintendent, were subsequently charged for covering up evidence of another earlier rape case, according to the New York Times. The FBI raided Lostutter in June 2013, and he is facing indictment under the CFAA. Noah McHugh was allegedly arrested earlier in February. If convicted, they face much longer prison sentences